Everyone, thank you for taking the time and lending your ears to these various conversations. Very excited to share all the guests that I have with you this season. And in order for this season to be a success, I need you guys to help share the word and spread the love of the What Makes You Tick pod. While you're listening, please take a moment to like or subscribe to the podcast wherever you are. And as always, I really appreciate all the help and the support that you guys have given me in the last four seasons. Let's hopefully make this one the best.
I feel that if you put yourself in a little bit of a hole, most days, you think about where the next breath is coming from, not about where you're making the next few pounds or where the problems are. If you have to struggle to know when you're going to get your next breath, it brings everything into perspective and it brings it back down to the other. Where I'm good at the 6 inches job, 6 inches in front of your face, like that, any given Sunday speech.
Welcome, Mel Dean, to What Makes You Tick. Mel is my guest today, and as some people may know Mel as this cheeky chappy who is the trainer to the stars. Others may remember him as a super rugby player who played with Connacht and Richmond and others, and we'll get to that. But I was introduced to Mel through a friend of ours, Garrett Logan, and Logie thought you had a really, really good story to tell. So I then followed you and I started to kind of get an insight into who you are, what you're about. And I must say, you've entertained me on regular occasions, but I'm delighted to have you on board. Great to see you, big man.
Thanks for letting me on to have a chat.
You nervous?
No. What makes me tick? I don't know what makes me tick, but this could be good. This could be good for me as it is for you.
We might figure it out. So, Mel, I think what would be good is to give people a bit of an insight into who you are, right? And where you've come from and what you're all about. Because you're living in London, right? But you were born in Longford, right? So
I was actually born in London.
Born in London, but grew up in Longford then?
Grew up in Longford, yeah.
Jesus, yeah. Yeah, okay. So the research, one of the interviews I listened to about you as well threw me off. So tell me the story. Tell us the story.
Well, my dad used to run the Crown in Cricklewood, which was synonymous with the Irish in London. You know, when anybody would be meeting to go working on the buildings during the day, I'll meet you on the forecourt of the Crown, collect me there at 6 o'clock in the morning or 5:30 or whatever it was. So that is just, if you mention the Crown in Cricklewood to a certain age group, they'll go, oh, Mel Dean, the Crown in Cricklewood, oh. Because he's Mel as well. I'm little Mel. And I'm actually minor. There was granddad was called Mel as well. So I'm the little fart. So
okay.
But yeah, so I was conceived upstairs in the Crown in Cricklewood. And then dad left the Crown. Mum didn't want to be in the pub game. And so dad came back to Longford and set up a glass reinforced plastics, Longford GRP, which like converted transit vans into buses and tractor cabs and all that jazz. But I grew up in Longford until I was 13 and then went back to England. So I'm a bit of a traveler, really.
That's okay. You're a posh traveler. It's fine. But come here. What age were you when you left Longford? 13, was it?
13, yeah.
So what was it like? What was it like growing up in Longford then? Because like, obviously Ireland is fairly fucking different now, right?
Longford was a top town, obviously. I went everywhere on the bike, cycled into St. Michael's in the town on the bike, in the morning, back out at lunch and back in. You know, it was brilliant. I loved Longford. It was great, great memories there. And I still have a lot of pals that grew up there with me and went to Ross Gray, some of them, Clongowes, some of them. Yeah, so there's, it's great to have a network of people there and here in London, and the teams I've played with, Manchester, and I'm very, very lucky to have some great people that I've played with and I've gone to school with. And yeah, I'm very lucky for the people that are around me, to be honest.
And so, did you start playing rugby back in Longford, or had you played it all the way through, or what way, when did you get stuck into rugby?
Longford, underage. I started in Longford at seven.
Did you?
On the cabbage patch, which is now 3G, the state-of-the-art job. It looks savage. It was like, I can't believe they have this facility.
Your career would have been so different.
They're shy. I used to run around in. Longford, great memories of Longford, 100%.
There's a story Logie mentioned to me about you. Was it you and your dad? So your dad was a bit of a brawler, was he? Is that true?
Yeah.
So is there like, you obviously had the respect of the town, did you?
Well, I was very young at the time, but dad would have been I would have witnessed an awful lot more fighting than I really should have, probably.
Yeah.
Because a cardinal sin for someone to stick the fingers up at dad in the car was like, that was unbelievable. Dad had pulled the car in and like on the window, what did you do to me? And they'd be like, if they confronted him, there was a fight happened.
Yeah.
If they didn't and kept the window up and didn't open the door, they stayed away from the storm, so to speak. But
it was a different Ireland though back then, wasn't it? Like, it was a totally different world. Like, you're growing up with a sense of like, it was all about respect, wasn't it? It was all about like, you respected the kind of the three pillars of the society, which was bloody church, which was the church, the police, and the teachers. They were the kind of the three kind of pillars. And then that kind of faltered the way down, that you had respect for your elders. And if anybody tried to disrespect you, it was here we go.
Yeah. But, I would go along with that 100%. So I witnessed an awful lot of that as a youngster.
Do you think that steeled you? Did it like steel you a little bit, you know?
To be honest, when I was a bit of a turnip as a young lad. I was eating Mars bars to the band playing. Honestly, dad would come in and I'd hear the truck come in on the cattle grids. Ga-ding, ga-ding. And I was like, dad's back. I'm not asleep. And I'd open the window. Dad would lob in Twixes and Mars bars and all that stuff. I'd be sitting in the bed, like smashing through it. I was a little fat turnip. Anyway, I used to have, because I was running around, I was cycling or running, I was nonstop. I am sure that they would say I had ADHD or whatever they'd say, they'd have diagnosed, they'd have given me something to slow me down because I was full on, nonstop. Yeah. I used to have, which is kind of a bit hideous, but I used to have sores, right, on my earlobes. Because the sweat would always be running off my earlobes. I know, it's hard to believe. It is hard to believe what a minging little child I was.
I was like literally raining off your earlobes.
I'm sorry, it's sores just on the small bits here in my ears. And because I was always cycling or running or just nonstop. But I remember that, like, there was obviously when dad would get angry and get out to lamp someone, my sister and myself would be in the back seat, go, oh my god, oh no, oh no, oh no, and we'd slide down the back seat, you know, when you go, oh Jesus, no. Yeah. But I remember in the rugby club, one of the older age group called me a fat something or another, and I'd obviously witnessed dad knocking the heads off fellas. So I turned around. I said, what did you call me? And it used to be, remember the push. He pushed me. I went, boom, in on top of him. Like plowed into him, blood everywhere. And people looked at me then. I was like, don't mess with him. And there was something about that that was, I don't know, there was not endearing, but there was definitely I like to be I'd like to be wary. People be wary of me. Don't muck around with me. And I brought that. It needs to say, coming to England, you Irish this, you Irish that, bang into the mouth, plow into them immediately, and then they go, oh, don't say that to him, or he'll turn on you. And so that aggression kind of served me well, even though I was uber polite. But that's what I would be like, seriously, like, yes, please, no, thanks, how are you doing? I'd be very engaging. Yeah. But if someone was disrespectful, they'd have to be able to front up, or I would confront them, bang, and then they'd understand, oh, I've got the situation wrong. I remember saying to people, don't get mixed up me being polite with being soft. Don't get that mixed up. And I didn't mind getting in fights. And rugby, like collisions. I loved smashing into people. I loved it. That was my kind of...
How do you deal with that now?
I still play rugby.
Okay, do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I play for the heavies in Richmond. And, you know, it's all fun and games until someone runs at you and tries to run over you. And you go, oh, yeah. And then because I've trained, needless to say, since I was a little fella, all my life, I trained. So that gets that initial bite out of you. But the collisions were the things that I missed. That full-on boom, you know, that rocking yourself. I used to love smashing people. I used to love it.
And give people a bit of an insight into your rugby career as well, because you did play at pretty much the highest level going at the time, and when you left Longford,
but actually my twist of fate story is, when I left Longford at 13, it was 1988 when I left Longford, and Dad was in America at the time, and Mum was wanting to go back to London. And I was going to see Dad with my sister in New York. He was in Queens, in Astoria. And Shelley and myself used to go out and see Dad every Christmas, Easter, summer, like that. And this particular Christmas, Mum and Dad were separating. And I said, Mum, do you want to come and make it a family Christmas? And Mum was kind of reliving her youth in London that she missed out when she was in the arsehole of nowhere in Longford, in a field in Longford. So my mum said, oh, no, you go with your sister. I said, no, Mum, you come make it a family Christmas. So Dad was the money man. Mum phoned Dad. Dad went to put Mum on the same flight as us, no seat on the flight that we're on, but the terminals that were where the company Shelley and myself were on, and the Air India where Mum was going to be put on, have to be put on, was 45 minutes later, only 45 minutes later. But the Air India terminal in JFK is miles from where we would be landing.
Okay.
So we were taken off that flight and put on the other flight. And the flight that we were taken off was Pan Am Flight 103 that blew up over Lockerbie on the 21st of December, 1988. So I was in the departure lounge with everybody that died on that flight, and we were booked on it. And only for me saying to Mum, make it a family Christmas, Shelley and myself were on that flight. So that is my little twist of fate story.
What does that kind of, that's obviously stood to you, right?
Yeah. I kind of say things. I generally say what's on my mind, whether it's maybe a good thing or a bad thing, but I generally say what's on my mind.
Yeah.
So and
Jesus, that's harrowing, like, because.
Yeah, but Dad was in Manhattan walking away. Flight from JFK to, sorry, from Heathrow to JFK has been blown up over Lockerbie. There are no survivors.
Oh, sure. I'd say he thought it was.
Yeah. So he's on the phone to the travel agent who assured me we were on the Air India flight. There was like a 10-hour delay. No planes were taken off.
Yeah, because you didn't have any social media back then, pal.
No.
Didn't have any phone calls or mobile phones then. Jesus,
there was a fellow on a payphone that said to his Mum, it's me, I'm not on the plane that went down. Because they didn't tell us anything.
Yeah.
I said, did you hear your man? They're not on the plane that went down. So something's gone wrong. And that's all we knew until we got to JFK. And then it was like, mayhem.
My God. Yeah. My God. It is an amazing twist of fate. Like, and not to dwell on it, a very, very good friend of mine, his partner at the time was on the Air France flight that went down. Yeah. And like, so it's, I can't believe I'm speaking to somebody who's like, you were so close to that, right? To the Lockerbie. And I know somebody who was so close to another plane disaster. Like, it's just, the world is too small now, you know?
Well, yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it just, it does put it into perspective, pal. I must say, like, because since then, now you've gone on to do brilliant things, right? So you went on and played a bit of ball, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's great escapism for me. Rugby was escapism, definitely. Because you,
and do you think that rugby kind of helped you calm and control any of that kind of that brutal response trigger?
Yes, yeah. Definitely. Yeah, and I boxed in Longford as well.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah, but I was only actually saying that to somebody else. Who was saying that? I was saying to someone only the other day, there's now you can't, at an underage, you can't hand off, but you could hand off then as a youngster. And I used to box as well. So they initially at underage, they put me in as a prop because I was a little fat turnip. And they put me in as a prop. And then I was like, oh, I don't know about this. And then gave me the ball. First, you can hand them off, hand into the face, bang, like rocking fellas' heads back. they're not tackling me. Boom, bang, try. I was like, this is great. This is the job for me. And I'd have bogeys on my hands and everything from melting lads into the face. So I was like, and I got a little bit of respect for playing well and being good at that. So that's where I kind of, why rugby was so good for me, definitely.
Is there anybody from that time in your life that you look up to, that you had admiration for, like that has had a big, big impact in who you are now today?
Well, apart from dad would have been, yeah, because a physical person, dad would have been very physical, so that's, I kind of gone that way. But it's funny, my sister is a doctor of conflict. She's, her politics is her thing, but she's the cerebral conflict, and I am the physical conflict. So it's a funny one, yeah. Shelley's there.
That's really interesting. Does she ever talk to you about, here, listen, this is how you need to deal with these things?
Well, Shelley is a bit of a temper herself. I'm not going to say any more than that. but she's a legend. My sister's a superstar.
And you guys are close.
Yes, very close, yeah. She's a year and 5 months older than me, yeah.
But, is she? Okay.
Yeah.
It's so when you came over then to the UK, then did you get straight into rugby then over there? Did you find your kind of feeling, or was it a case of going over with a chip in your shoulder type of thing and then redirecting?
Because when I started going to school in London, my mum said, you need to get yourself playing rugby again. I was like, yeah, 100%. So that, because rugby, if I was moving somewhere now, even if I'm at the age I am, and I go somewhere, I want to go to a rugby club and play for the oldies, and you're immediately plugged into people that know this area, you know, and I get respect quickly.
Because, is that important to you?
Yeah, because I'd smash people, and they go, oh, that's great to have that in the team. Because I don't drink, I'm a pioneer.
Okay.
So never drank ever, dad never drank ever. All that. So when I go to a team and they go, oh, the initiation for, especially if university, is like, you know, 10 pints, then shorts, then get sick in a bag and stick it on top of your head. And I, well, I don't drink. And then they go, no, everybody does it. He didn't drink and he didn't. I don't drink. Oh, the initiation, but for the first team, you have to, I don't drink. And then they're thinking, he doesn't drink.
He really doesn't drink.
This lad's not, he's not for bending, this lad. And I play, melt people, he's playing, he's all right. We can let him, he can get away with not doing the initiation, you know. Yeah. So, actually, quite a funny story. When Ruislip was the first team I came to in England, and I played for a couple of years there, but I went to Wasps as a 16-year-old for the Colts, which was under 90, so I was miles too young. But, I immediately played at Wasps and played the first week I was there and got stuck into it. There was older lads and Delally was there and Gomers, and there was a whole lot of good players around me, which I felt was which was good for me to be around good players. It always ups your game, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember we were on tour in Dublin at the Coles tour, and they were like, obviously you can hear the lads, the Dublin team, going, "These English bastards," you know, all this kind of stuff. And them in the Wasp team going, "These Irish hooers," and then I'm in the middle of obviously listening to this. Yeah. Or I'm just getting stuck in. For whoever the team I'm playing for, I'm getting stuck in anyway. It doesn't matter. But yes, and so, but the long and the short of it was, the boys had a few drinks that night, and they said, "We're getting Wasp tattoos on our arses. We're getting Wasp tattoos." I said, "Lads, whoa, no, lads, I'm sober. You listen to me. I'm, you know, man, we're getting them. We're getting a Wasp tattoo on our arse in Dublin. One, this was after the match or whatever." I said, "Lads, you're not. We are. Have you got your wallets, lads?" And they went, "Yeah, are you sure?" And they both of them put their hands in their pockets and they held them out like this. And I went, boom, two wallets on me toes. I was gone.
Yeah. Voice of reason, Meldeen.
There was no phones then for jab and stuff. It was like, I had their wallets, I'm gone. And one of the lads who I stopped them getting a tattoo that day, he introduced me to a fella. He's the most uncouth individual ever. He said, "Mel, do you know, just wait a second. Can you just show Mel your..." And he's just pulling the jacket up, "Your shit tattoo." And this guy had a shell on the middle of his back. It was an appalling tattoo. But he said, "But it makes me think of you, Mel. You remember when you robbed..." I was going to have a shit tattoo on my arse. He said, "But this shit tattoo makes me think of you robbing the wallet."
It's good that you were coming up in strange conversations. you definitely helped people along the way, that's for sure.
Yes.
So when you played, let's talk through the teams that you played with, because you played at a really, really, really good level. And all, as you said there a minute ago, like, sport is an unbelievable way of getting you into the community and kind of making you feel part of something, right? Yeah, so maybe let's talk about the different teams and maybe describe which team actually made you feel most welcome.
I felt I belonged in Wasps, actually, but even though it stood for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. I felt really at home there. Great lads, and I had really good pals, and still have good pals from that time, you know. So but it is just that you're plugged into a new... You gain respect immediately. If you put your head on the line and you do things that other people don't do necessarily and put yourself in harm's way, you get respect. That's the thing about rugby. If you play with some lads, he plays well. But when he plays well, is he run over someone, or he'd be physical, or all the things that you need to be committed to be.
Yeah.
To excel, you have to be committed in all different areas, but they tend to be rugby lads. There's only a very few people that I don't get on with in rugby.
Yeah.
There's similar mentality, even though they drive you mentally, obviously, when they're drinking and they're over the top and you want to go, "Oh, please." But they're playing generally, there's a good feedback from even after the game, even if you're getting piled into each other and it was dirty enough. One particular centre I used to play against, he was dirty, and we always used to have like a bit of fisticuffs, the pair of us, because he was just over the top all the time. But he unfortunately was paralysed in a game, and basically I couldn't stand him as a player. But he was at Sale, and I ended up going to Sale after he had his injury. And I went to see him, because he was in Stanmore Spinal Unit. Andy Blythe, his name is, was a centre, good player. And I went to see him in the bed, and he was half the size he was, obviously, because he wasn't moving. But he managed to get moving again over time, and he's... able to live a super duper life now. He's moving, but at the time, they never thought that was going to happen.
course,
and
yeah.
To go and see him in the bed, and
wow. Did that change your perspective or your thinking of it?
What to play?
Yeah,
no, it's always the same. I was only
you're fearless, knew, fearless,
yeah,
like
I only knew that way to play. Yeah, that was that. Yeah, that.
And after seeing him, like, so you went to Sale, you essentially took his position then, did you? Okay, and how long did you spend in Sale?
I was in Sale until 2003, and I went mid season to it was 2003, mid season to Harlequins, because it was Dan Harris and myself that were getting the nod for starting at 12, and I got man of the match against London Irish 1 week and was dropped the next. And I was like, I can't stand this. I can't. This is driving me mad. But it was so funny. Jim Mallander was the coach at the time. He'd tell you and laugh for himself. And he said, so we're dropping you, man. We're starting with, you're on the bench. And I was like, oh my God. And I stood up and I was like, and it was one of these prefix buildings. It wasn't a solid structure. And I walked out and I was like, I want to hit something very hard. And the wall was obviously in front of me. So I just went with my elbow at the wall, right? Poof. And my elbow goes through the dry rock, you know what I mean? Bang, through the dry rock, out the other side, hits folders on on a, like, what would you call those drawers? Those are metal drawers.
Yeah, yeah.
And they all flew onto Phil Winstanley's table. He thought the place was coming down. He was like, what the hell is going on?
An earthquake.
And I buried my elbow through it. I went through the two of them. And then I was like, I just walked out. And then Jim Allender never said a word about it. He said, if everybody was that keen to play, we'd have some team.
Interesting. So, interesting, yeah. Isn't it? It does. It does kind of lead, like, you know, the way there's it's players are, and people now are kind of encouraged to keep an eye on themselves and manage their anger and manage their reaction and don't let people influence you or affect you. If you had that approach, your coach would have thought that you didn't care. Now, not saying it's the right thing to do, right? But in saying that, it's like it did show that you had the passion and it showed that you had a drive. And like, if you were in that position again now, would you react the same or would you do things differently now, considering who you are now?
Looking back, I'd probably not as fired up as I was then, because I felt I was flying. You know, when you say, I can't, what? How? If I was playing like shite, I understand. If I was playing badly, I was playing well, and one of those things. But then I came down to Quinns literally the week or so after Nick Duncombe had passed away. And so it was very subdued in the club then. And it was just before a transfer window, and Harlequins weren't doing well. But I settled in there pretty quickly. And then the following summer, there was like an influx of Paddies. It was like there was more Irish playing at Quinns than there was at London Irish, which was really funny. It was a funny one. But each club is a bit of a different chapter for me.
Yeah.
Establishing myself as a professional. I was a young professional at Richmond, just wet behind the ears. Everybody else was capped around me, and, you know, and that was a great time to be around the Quinnells and all those like super players. And then at Sale, I was starting to develop then as a bit of a player, and I went on tour to New Zealand. And then actually it didn't go that well after that at Sale. I was playing well, but I didn't think I was getting as many games as I should. And then I went to Quinns, and that's when I had my daughters. And so each club is a different element for me. So, but they're all brilliant. I love Connacht, finishing in Connacht.
Yeah, because that's interesting. So you had your daughters in Quinns. Did they go with you to Connacht?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So like that's like setting up a whole new lifestyle for them as well. Like, over in the west coast of Ireland, where
in the west.
There's no hiding there.
Grace, my eldest, had a little bit of an Irish accent then, but that's long gone. That's long gone when we came back. But it was
With Connacht, when you got back to Connacht, you had an opportunity, you played Ireland A as well. So there's obviously, they were trying to get you involved with the Irish setup too, yes. Getting back involved. Was that one of the main reasons to go back?
No, because I was really at the end of my career, really. I was at the end, but I could have probably had another year or two, strung it out. But Richmond had offered me, they knew I was into the conditioning side of things, and they said, well, would you like to come back and
train here?
And I was like, I'm training the club. I was like, yeah, I'd love that. Because I had a good relationship with the accountant at the club.
It always helps.
Yeah, because he knew he was paying me feck all. This guy, good value.
Am I right in saying that you were in the middle of your studies when you were first offered a contract and you hadn't finished them? You went on to finish them then while you were in Richmond.
Yes, I was at Richmond. I'd only overlapped.
You're only a couple of weeks, isn't it?
It was 1 week. The 6th of June was my last exam.
Yeah,
and the contract started the 1st of June. So yeah. It was.
Brilliant. And that actually it leads me nicely into this, how did you find your way into fitness? So Richmond obviously played a huge role, and that's where you still are to this day, where you're coaching a lot of your clients, right?
Yes, it is. That's exactly why I'm in the same gym where I was as a professional. It's very funny. It was very different looking now, but it's the same building, if you know what I mean. I train people from when I was very young. I've trained people when I was in the pub. My dad had a pub in Willesden Green called Tony's, a McGovern pub, and I used to be downstairs boxing the bag. There's a punch bag downstairs, and my cousin and myself would be doing training down there between barrels, press ups, gas barrels. I love training. I train every week, and not every day, but I just love it.
What would you say then today are the things that motivate you and that inspire you now, and ultimately what make you tick now? Because we spoke a little bit about growing up and the fact that when you were walking through different environments, you demanded respect and you wanted respect from people, and you earned that respect from people by doing playing hard and being even harder off the pitch, right? But now that you have a family, and now that you have got two beautiful girls, right? Two beautiful daughters. Like, what are the things that kind of motivate you now?
trying to have a few pounds in my pocket for them is an important thing. It's important to be happy, isn't it? It's important to enjoy what you do. Luckily, I've got paid for doing things that I would do for free, basically. Luckily,
do you think you've got that? You've built up that reputation and value, or not value, but do you think you've built up your reputation as being highly respected in the industry because you love it?
I don't know. Maybe I'm infectious. Maybe to train in. Honestly, I annoy people. Honestly, I get paid to annoy people. I drive people ape. But
your Instagram page is fucking hilarious.
But if I don't enjoy training somebody, or it's like they kind of slip through the net. Some people, if they pester me to train, they come. They've sent a couple of times. They say, maybe they're keen. If they've messaged me like a half a dozen times, maybe they're keen. And then I get a bit of banter with them. If it's kind of half funny, I really have to get on with them. If I'm able to sit down and have a cup of tea with them and have a bit of crack, I'm training them. If I'm not. They're not. They're not staying. It's simple as that. They're not staying.
And it goes back to having a really important environment, right? So that's not only in your job, but it's also in your personal life as well. Like, if you're not happy, like in that environment, then make a change, pronto.
100%. And people, if this one, I don't like the vibe of this one. Or, you know, if I'm feeling that, and I'd say, well, you're nearly finished. Come on, now, you're nearly finished the warm up, and I'm absolutely pushing them to the wire here. And they go, warm up, right? And they look at you as, look, hey, I'm not for everybody. I'm not for everybody. Bang, you're not for me. Oop. Put that in your head.
Psychological warfare.
I remember one fella saying to me, I was asking him to do a farmer's carry to the tree and back or whatever with his weights. He had to put them down halfway and then came back. Is that an exercise? I was like, this guy's going to piss me off.
P45.
Surely this ceased to be an exercise when a cardo was invented and I didn't have to carry shopping bags. And I was like,
oh, wow. Yeah, you do. Yeah, like, and it's funny when people are trying to tell you what to do and how to do it. You know, I hear a lot of people. So actually, I'd love to get your input in this. If you're trying to lose weight, right? Weights or cardio?
How long is a piece of string?
I know.
I would preferably I'd do weights, but I'd pull the engine. Because you just, I pull the rest periods and you're keeping ticking over.
Yeah, yeah.
Muscle mass is going to eat the calories, you get me? So that's why I try and put.
And then
if I see somebody, I see what they're like. For me, I see what they're, what would they be like? Super fit. I mean, they'd have shoulders on them and they'd have legs and they'd have a bit of an arse on them. They'd be powerful individuals. That's how I see them. And that's how I want them to be. And then if I had a pound for every time a female said to me, oh, I don't want these. I don't want the big shoulders. I don't want the big arms. I don't want them. Yeah, you don't want them. There's thousands of lads in this country trying to get them, but you're going to get them from a couple of sessions with me. Is that what you're telling me? And they're going,
yeah. So
how do you dispel
those worries though? Because it's a lack of education, I think, or understanding when they see that. Because they see CrossFitters now and they see all these superhumans who are out there on social media and they're all constantly ripped, constantly toned, like they're always like, it's
sometimes it's a problem.
for anybody listening, as he kisses his bicep. Oh man, you got to watch this in the back on video now. We'll have great.
it's shocking. The stuff I listen to, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brutal.
How do you think a young Mel Dean would look? What do you think a young Mel Dean would think of you today?
That's a good one, isn't it? That's like that Matthew McConaughey. You're going for the you in 10 years, the best you in 10 years.
Green lights, yeah.
You did a lot of things that you enjoyed doing, I have to say that. But see, obviously my dad would have given me a work ethic, a massive work ethic. My dad was unbelievable for grafting. So in the summers, I work on the building sites and I'd be working in the pubs in the evening for dad, because dad had a pub when we were growing up. I would be working evenings, buildings in the summer, which put shoulders on me, you know, wheelbarrowing, hard laboring, made you strong, that kind of meaty strong, you know what mm-hmm. I mean?
So, yeah.
When I was doing that, I knew once I was a player that this, I get to play and get paid. So it was a dream. Imagine I could do, as long as I could play, as long as I wanted to play and I was injury free, I go back to working, having to work hard when I have to work hard. But he's not working hard. This is joyous. This is absolutely joyous. I train hard, be as fast, as strong, you know, and I say it to young lads now, because that's what I like. I like training youngsters as well as people my own age, who we can have a bit of crack, youngsters. that I try to get across to them. If a fair game is a game between people of equal abilities, but if I can make one side 15% stronger, faster, it starts to become an unfair game then. And then you say, what side of that unfair game do you want to be on? And you see the young fella going, yeah, I want to be the stronger, faster. And so, and as a player, I felt, I know it sounds mental, but I felt that I was bulletproof. I don't care what they're coming at me with. They are the same as me. They sit down to shite as well as I do. There's nobody any better than me. We're all the same. But I am going to want it more than you. You are not going to want it more than me.
So a lot of people go through life with that imposter syndrome kind of mentality, right? That they shouldn't be there. They shouldn't be in a certain room or in a certain position, and they kind of doubt themselves immediately. Whereas it sounds like that you backed yourself 100% in because you loved what you're doing. And but going back to my initial question though, because I think you skirted around it a little bit, like a young Mel Dean looking at you now, what would a young Mel Dean say? Like being really frank and honest, like with it. And we're not sponsored by them, by the way. What do you think you'd say? Because there's a job for us to do to make our eight year old selves proud in some way, right?
Yeah, you're here. I did what I loved. I really don't know what I'd say.
So what advice would you give your young self then? Rather than having him look at you, what would you say to him, knowing that you're going to go through all the different challenges that you have gone through and all the successes that you've gone through and all the various experiences that you've lived with? Like, what advice would you give that kid who's about to kick off?
I'd say study a bit more, even not to fob it off, because I wanted to be a superstar. You know, when the superstar was on the TV, I want to be a superstar. I want to play. I'm going to play as high a level as I can. I'm going to be a sports person. That's it.
Yeah. And
that was just in my head to do that. And even though I was looking, I had said the girlfriend I had at 16, I ended up marrying. So that I didn't have those distractions as much as anyone else. And I wasn't drinking and I was working and I was grafting. And I knew that the playing, if I could play, that would be great. So I was quite focused for that. Luckily, I was focused for that, and I had that determination that I wasn't going to be beaten on the day. I was going to be the best 12 on the park or 13 or whatever position I was in. What would a youngster say about it?
It's nearly just like back yourself. It kind of feels like you while education, maybe educated or study a little bit more, but you backed yourself all the way to where you are today, and you were instilled with that grafting kind of mentality, which a lot of people don't have and are afraid of or have never experienced it because of softness or lack of exposure or whatever. But like, from what I'm listening to you and hearing in your story, it's like embrace the hard work, embrace the challenge, it'll take time, but it'll pay off in the long run.
Yes. I played rugby with so many lads that were better than me in their own aspects of, they could pass so well, or they could get faster than me, or I was quite strong, so they didn't always lift more than me. But they should have done, so many lads, pals of mine, should have done so much better than me. But they didn't have the, I won't be beaten, top 2 inches here.
Yeah.
They didn't. And Yeah, and that's I would definitely have that. That was in me massively.
So I suppose you can pass, you could probably look at it then with your two daughters, right? What's the, like, if you were to have a message, one message to leave them, what would that be? What would you be saying to them?
What would my message to the girls be? It's a tough one that. Do what you love. Do what you love. Whatever it may be, you'll get money, you'll get whatever the trappings that come, do what you love. 100%.
Yeah, that's
Because I was going, when I retired from playing, because I grew up in pubs, I could run a pub. I was very meticulous in running pubs. I could run a pub. I did the licensee. To be a licensee, I did that little course thing or whatever it was to so you could be a licensee. And but I was training I did things that I transpires that I get paid for things that I just love doing. I was training people before I became a professional, when I trained like a professional, before I was a professional. I became the professional. I was paid to be a professional. On the tail end of that, I started training people, back into training people. S&C Richmond, what I did, I loved. And luckily, I was still in that kind of environment for people, the banter, the lads. So I didn't have that drop off like a lot of fellas have their play and they miss the lads, the crack, bang, silence. There's no change in them anymore, which is a big drop off for a lot of fellas where they're into the city and they're working and they're not necessarily the same people. But I was very lucky in that regard. And then I trained people to get, I was paid to train people that I was doing really anyway. I ended up training because I love training. People were training with me and they said, you're training me? You want to come in early? And so that was always happening before I was training, been paid to train people. So I actually looked that into maybe doing that security, like close personal security, because that's what I end up doing when I'm not a night out. My nickname is Robo because this is it, I'm sober and I'm so used to dealing with issues in pubs. When you are in a pub and there is a fight in a pub and your dad is the manager and they want to plow into the manager and bury the manager and he's your dad, you get used to being in rows. Unfortunately, I am so good in chaos. I mean, there's no panic to it. It's you don't panic, you just, this is the situation. What's the next best thing to do now? This red second, now. And this time, now, what's the best thing to do now? That would be, I'd say, my superpower and my weakness, because I don't look far enough in the future. It's here, bang. It's here.
Yeah. It's you spoke there about moving, so not having to kind of have that experience where there's a gap where you move from playing to all of a sudden the drop in silence, right? And you went into coaching and to training and stuff. For anybody who does follow you on Instagram, you have some of the most hilarious content out there between abusing and messing with all your clientele to the different memes and videos that you stick up randomly on your stories. How did you get to the point where, and it's no secret, like you've got people like Rio Ferdinand training with you, you have Kirsty Gallagher training with you. I've always been a massive fan, and watching her over the years doing all the different documentaries in sport and everything. But you've had Gabby Logan, you've had, and then you have Stevie, who's a little celebrity in his own right.
Honestly, it's so funny. People come up to him, like when he's on holiday, when he's away from anyone, I'm going to tell Mel what you're eating. And then he'll go, he can't believe that. It's very funny.
Yeah, but how did you kind of build that clientele and then expand from there?
Well, Gabby, I suppose, was one of the first people of notoriety probably that I trained because of Kenny. I was really good pals with Brian Redpath, who was a Scottish international at Sale. He was the captain at Sale, and really good pals with Kenny Logan, needless to say, a Scottish player. And then I was down here in Richmond, and I see Kenny, and Kenny's company was here in Richmond. And he said, oh, Gabby's looking for a PT. Her PT's gone. So I said, oh, come and get her to come. I'll come and train her. Gabby, Catherine Jenkins. Then they go, and then it just kind of, yeah. And then you say, oh, I know her. Then boom, KG, then Niall Horn. Then, and then, you know, so there was a gang after that. Even though there was a couple in between that were, actually, there was one, you know, Nick Frost.
Nick Frost, was he on
Shaun of the Dead? Remember, he's the one who does the like the monkey noises. You know what I mean? But he is a hoot. What a crack he is. But I was thinking I need to train someone who's a bit of a unit. Nick, who's a bit of a unit, and I need to train them up so they look freaking decent, and you can see that they've lost weight. Bang, who trained them? Bang, me. I trained them. You know, so that's what I was thinking. And I messaged them on Twitter. And this is before Instagram was so popular. And we had a couple of to and fro. And I messaged him and said, "How about some fitness sessions at Richmond Rugby? Your currency shall be laughter and sweat." Question mark, question mark.
What a message.
What? Why would I say this? What? And bang, straight back. Explain. So I say, look, I'm at Richmond Rugby Club. He said he had a rugby background, was a prop, needless to say, big unit. Took ages for him to come and train me, but I trained Chris Hemsworth a few times as well. And he was in what was the name of the movie? He was in the name of the movie was called, it was something to do with, not Snow White, The Huntsman. The Huntsman. Anyway, I went to see Chris at an onset with all the horses there and all that kind of jazz. And we had a bit of a chat or whatever, but he was in the next scene. Nick Frost was in the next scene with Chris. And he's like, oh, hi, how are you? I said, yeah, that's him. That's your man. We messaged a couple of times. And anyway, he eventually ended up coming to train. And I could see I'm quite good at reading faces. Not just the face that's like this, as if I'm ghost. Don't give me another rep of anything. But I can see, like, your eyes, when there's no oxygen in you, your eyes have that kind of look as if, oh, Jesus. But anyway, I was thinking, I didn't want to stress him out too much because he was quite heavy. So I said, can you get me a heart rate monitor so I know where you are and I won't like put you over 140, 150. And if that happens, we'll pull you back down, we'll rest and we'll go again and we'll build. You know, we don't have to enjoy the process. Don't smash them all the first time. And so he eventually got the heart rate monitor and I could see that he was getting a little bit stressed in his face. And I said, Nick, can you just give me a little check there on the heart rate, please, and thanks? And he looked like this, and he went, four figures can't be right, can it? And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. Imagine 1,000 beats per minute. really made me chuckle. But really good lad. A lot of time for him. A lot of time for him. But I've trained his kids since. And luckily, I have great people. Honestly,
I think what I'm getting from this, Mel, and I genuinely can't wait to meet you in person, right? And I know we said it before that we'll do a session whenever I'm in London, but you never know when you're back over here. Jesus, if you can get me in good shape like Chris Hemsworth, I can do anything. but what I am getting out of it though is that starting off and growing up and all that big thing was about making sure that people respected you. And I think what I'm finding now, though, is in the work that you're doing now is that people genuinely respect you from the hard work and effort that you put into your business and in making sure that people are not only getting the benefit physically, but mentally as well, because we all have tough, different things going on in our lives behind the scenes. And on top of that, you're no different, right? So how do you manage yourself? Because like you're one of these characters that seems to be there for everybody else, right? You're a robo twat when you're out when everyone else is having pints, but you're looking after everybody and keeping an eye on them. You're that piece of the puzzle of people's lives when they need to get health and fitness into their lives. You give them both the therapy as well as the physical improvements. But like, how do you take care of yourself?
I like training. It's, I don't know, it's mental. It's a busman's holiday, really. But not all the time, but I ship out my fitness to someone else. I go to a CrossFit in Sunbury, with a lad that I used to be at uni with, Canoe. I can't remember why we call him Canoe, but Canoe is his nickname. And great lad, and it's hard work. People don't mess about. You're working hard, you're training hard. I feel that if you put yourself in a little bit of a hole most days, you think about where the next breath is coming from, not about where you're making the next few pound or where the problems are. If you have to struggle to know when you're going to get your next breath, it brings everything into perspective and it brings it back down to here where I'm good at the 6 inches job, 6 inches in front of your face, like that Any Given Sunday speech. If you are a team person and you listen to that speech, you will know exactly the speech I'm talking about. When he's shouting at the lads, it's the 6 inches in front of your face. It's the fella who's willing to die for that inch that is going to feel alive, you know. So that would be very much resonate with me massively. That give it all, give it your all, and you'll feel that you reap the rewards after that. But I know there's things have to be done down the line, but I'm so here and now. Like I said, it's my superpower and it's my biggest weakness.
So
yeah,
that's brilliant. Listen, I know we've taken up plenty of your time. The pod is focused on helping others learn and find ways to improve throughout our lives, right? So,
but that was the one thing I was going to say about what some people say to me, what would you say to a PT? What would you say to a PT as they're starting off? What is it? And I said, I would say that my USP would be I am able to judge by asking someone, how are you today? That question is the most underrated question. How are you today? And on the response that I get back, on the level of energy that I can deem from that person, do I nail them to the cross with a massive session? Do I give them a middling session, or do you give them a few curls for the girls and make them laugh and they head out the door smiling and they feel better and they'll put the big effort in the next time? I think that is the thing that's the hardest to get, because when I was training as a professional, this is your livelihood. If you don't perform, you don't get paid. You will not have a contract. You will not be able to feed your family. It goes bang. It's very simple. But when you're coaching an amateur outfit, Richmond, but they get a couple of money here and there, they're working day in, day out. It has to be fun, but it has to be as much bang for your buck in every session as you can. That I'm pushing their fitness, that they're able to live with lads that are professionals. They have to be able to live with them, but they're not professionals. So you're not allowed absolutely ball bag them to win an inch of their lives, because they won't come back. Why would I do that? I'm not getting paid enough to do that. To be on that line of amateur professional, but the best of the amateur, that's the line. you have to be good at keeping.
Love it. So listen, the podcast is yours. The platform is yours. Not that you need it, but tell people what's going on. What's happening in the next couple of months in your life? Where can they find you? And what could they expect from the Big Mel Dean?
What can they expect from the Big Mel Dean that's 5 foot nine?
Jesus, you're bigger sitting than you are standing.
What can they expect? I suppose more of the same, but I'm trying to set up so they can people can do online classes via FitWith. You'll see it on my socials or whatever, but I'm trying to set that up currently, and because it's hard to be just in front of someone hour after hour. And so ideally this is how people can keep ticking over, and because I like everybody to be fit. When people go, Mel, come and see you, I say, come and train, and we'll have a session together, and we lift a bit of tin, and then we go and have a butter beans or whatever after, have a bit of porridge and a cup of tea and a slice of bread and jam or something, you know.
So is that what I have to look forward to, is it?
Getting absolutely bet in the gym and then go for some food.
Sounds brilliant. I can't wait.
That's a plan.
I'd love that. Love to see what happens when Mel Dean and myself train. We might even you can abuse me as well that day. I've no problem. come here, I'll put all the information in the show notes. But listen, I think what you're doing is brilliant. I think you're putting smiles on people's faces, but you're also like being genuinely honest with everybody as well when it comes to training, when it comes to the benefits of health, and when it comes to, I know you've got a couple of charity things that you're doing as well. So like, keep doing what you're doing, pal. Like you're genuinely knocking it out of the park. I think there's a lot of things that we can take from this that people will learn, like finding respect and focusing on that over the years in your life has helped you get to where you are. But you do it now with there's a really important message in there. Like, just because I'm kind and nice and polite, don't take that as a softness or a weakness, because it's the complete opposite. And I genuinely apply that to my life as well, in terms of, just because I'm nice, don't think I'm weak. And it definitely is something that people are surprised with, especially when the shit hits the fan, you know? So, yeah, listen, keep doing what you're doing, big man. Great to have you on board.
Thank you very much, buddy. Thanks. Great. Thanks for having me.
Once again, thank you for joining me on season 4 and taking part in this journey where we talk to people like you and me about what motivates them, what inspires them, and ultimately what makes them tick. I've learned so much from the various conversations I've had, and I hope you can take something from this that you can apply to your life. That's why this podcast has been created. I'm very proud of it. And I'm very thankful for everybody who's joined me so far. Thank you all for listening.